you know, we've been talking about the Canadian thing for like a month now. Mm-hmm. I guess that's sort of wrapped up now. It's kind of amazing how it just sort of everybody's attention has shifted away from COVID too. COVID's not really like being talked about, and the Canadian thing is sort of just. This is now the Ukraine thing has sort of taken over everything on the timeline from what I've seen.
Not surprising, you know, I mean, with there being like deaths involved and explosions and such. Alleged. And it being like, well, yeah, alleged.
I'm joking.
And it being like, you know, this whole theater of like the coming Third World War and all that kind of stuff. It's not surprising that people kind of dropped or put on the back burner, at least. The Canada COVID stuff, because I mean, even here in the United States, I wasn't seeing too much outside of our corner of like dissident Twitter and stuff about people even talking about Canada. But one interesting thing with that is that there is a DC truck convoy that's heading there right now Washington, DC. And they've been actually setting up like the National Guard in Washington, DC, and gave the go ahead for military personnel to be there to greet the protesters when they arrive, which is kind of a big step here in the United States. But that's just kind of like no one knows about that since, you know, the Russia-Ukraine thing is going on. But I mean, there's just cause because the Russia-Ukraine thing is a big deal.
Yeah. And before we jump into that, like, Alexi, like, what did you have any was there a lot of that news around where you are of the Canadian stuff and like what sort of like impact do you feel like it had?
Yeah, so obviously there was obviously news as well, but the interesting point I wanted to note is, you know, on last Friday, you know, just in time for the war, the American CDC revised its COVID risk formula, and with this change, the pandemic abruptly eased in America. It's like basically like from 90% of the United States in high risk red, it is now less than 30%. Yeah. And obviously, because you know we're not really you know talking about pandemic so much. We're focused obviously here on Russia, Ukraine. We're not really seeing what's happening, and they're quietly making all these changes in the back end. And I think there was a document released for the Democrats saying that, you know, okay, you know what, COVID has hurt a lot of people, and it's time to sort of ease on the messaging and not go hard on the lockdowns anymore. Yeah, which is like, you know, everyone's dropping mask mandate as well now. So, you know, they're doing it very quietly and they're going to act like they never supported this in the first place. So it's going to be very interesting. It's like, it's almost as if this Russia-Ukraine stuff is providing the perfect sort of, you know, curtain distraction for the Democrats to, you know, continue and, you know, ease off whatever shit show they were creating in America.
Yeah, and get the people who are like they have their like talons deeply sunk into to jump off of the dead horse that is now COVID and hop right onto this new thing, which is like war hawking for Eastern Europe conflict.
Yeah, it's like the software update. It's like, you know, your new task is to defend the territorial integrity of Ukraine and ensure that Ukrainians can have gay sex. So that's the new thing. So yeah.
Yeah, it's like the meme of BLM and then
this is at Trustworthy Slav.
This is at Incognito COH.
CRK Black.com build.
This is the Fed Post.
Exactly.
Like that Biden Harris, and then they have, you know, BLM, and then mask, wear a mask, get vax, and now it's like, what's the new thing? Okay, you know, Captain Ukraine is my new programming. You know, Captain America. Yeah, that shit. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it feels like they're, you know, it's the perfect out. It's the perfect. I mean, yeah, globally, like you said, in the UK and everywhere, it's sort of like there's been some pulling back. The motivations are up for debate. I mean, here it seems like midterms are definitely a factor. Seems like they've sort of ran, you know, a good. They've gotten what they wanted, and they're sort of running out of steam as far as like political capital. Like I hear libs talk about how they're sick of this. So I mean, they're kind of burnt out. The SNL is joking about it, you know, all that shit. So
that shit made me sick to my stomach.
That's the signal. That's the signal that it's okay to, you know, dissent from whatever the shit you were believing 1 week ago. So yeah, that's the signal. The bad signal to it's okay to relax now.
Yep. And so this Ukraine-Russia stuff, I mean, like, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I guess it's been sort of building up for the month. Like while the Canada stuff was going on, there was a lot of this kind of brewing. Mm-hmm. And
with the Olympics.
Right. Yeah, I remember you mentioned that last time. Yep. And then and I guess there was speculation like, are they even going to invade? Like that was up for debate. And then, you know, I guess it officially happened, you know, a couple of days ago. And yeah, I mean, basically the lib alignment is basically Putin bad. Putin is like Hitler. That's mm-hmm. the one I see a lot.
We see the never again posts that are like, never again was the war cry after World War II. But here we are as Putin bombs Ukraine and the streets are silent or some kind of crazy shit like that.
It's so stupid because, you know, you see all these European commentators are just like, oh, you know, this is like the first major war to grip the European continent after World War II. How can this happen? And they just completely memory hold the war crimes they were committing, deploying, you know, depleted uranium in Serbia in the war mm-hmm. Yugoslavia. You know, it's completely memory hold. There was this one incident on Twitter, it's a pretty famous incident here in the, you know, the Eastern European side of Twitter here, is that a Serbian guy, he posted photos of basically bombings of Serbia that were conducted by NATO. And he first said that, you know, this is, you know, what Russia is doing in Ukraine, and basically got all these big blue checks from Australia, UK and America to condemn it and blah, blah, blah. And then he said, oh, by the way, this is what your government did in Serbia. And then he got blocked. So it was a very, very funny thing about how all of this is just getting, you know, memory hold. But, you know, a lot of what people see, I think, seem to forget is that this is not a very recent conflict, and it is not what Putin is just decided that, you know, one day I'm going to get retarded and just sort of invade Ukraine because, you know, shit, we left the perks in Ukraine. No, not like that. But, no, it's this sort of thing has been in play for many years, and Putin's message on his own defending of his sphere of influence has not been changed for the last 15 years. You know, a lot, if you would look at his videos from, you know, all the way back 2008, 2009 or something, you can always find his defense of what he claims to be the Russian sphere of influence, which is, you know, defending against NATO expansionism. And I think this is exactly where the root of the problem begins, is, you know, I think now we can sort of veer into, you know, how this conflict started is, you know, obviously collapse of the Soviet Union, 1991, and essentially what Ukraine became after the Soviets gave territorial expansion following World War II and all that stuff was basically the eastern part and the southern part, like Crimea, is Russian-speaking, Russian ethnicity, and the mostly northern and western parts are Ukrainian ethnicity, right? They're like Ukrainian. So this was reflected in the elections that were taking place in Ukraine as well, you know, immediately after collapse of Soviet Union and, you know, thereafter as well, is you see these regions I just mentioned, south and east, kept voting for Viktor Yanukovych, who was the pro-Russia candidate. It was the party of regions, that was his party. And the north kept voting for some other guy. North and west voted for a more, you know, chilled out guy. And essentially what happened is that the sort of the matchstick that started this entire conflict was the Bucharest summit of NATO, which said that they would have open doors for Ukraine and Georgia to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, right? And this is obviously, you know, where this entire sort of thing starts for Russia. But, you know, this even NATO stuff has a lot of issues because Bill Clinton signed the first expansion of NATO into Poland, into, you know, all these countries of Eastern Europe that were part of the Warsaw Pact. And essentially what happened is this is not out anywhere in American media. You will find it in, you go to the, you know, German websites, German mainstream media, Der Spiegel or something, you will find leaked documents that state that UK and US gave security guarantees to Russia, saying that, you know, whatever happens, we will not expand NATO towards Warsaw Pact countries. NATO will stay within Germany, because obviously Germany unites, East-West Germany. It is not going to expand further. And obviously they go wave after wave after wave of NATO expansionism. And, you know, NATO, till this entire conflict started, was, even till today, Rome, like, it includes countries like, you know, Poland, Hungary, Romania, and, you know, for some former Yugoslav countries, obviously. And, you know, Russia definitely feels sort of, and even sort of the Baltic states, which I think are legitimate reasons to be in NATO. That's the one case I will excuse, because, you know, Baltics did get invaded by Russia in World War II. But other than that, you know, it was completely illegitimate reasons to expand NATO, other than the fact that, you know, we are the unipolar world hegemon and we can do whatever we want. And, you know, Russia couldn't stop. It was just what it was. But I think the shit show begins in Georgia in 2008. And I was pretty young for this war, so I did not follow it live. But I was like 9 years old or something. But basically what happened is, I think it was Edward Shevardnadze who was removed from power, and the NGOs, American NGOs, George Soros and all these people, their main supporting man was this guy called Mikhail Saakashvili. And Saakashvili he's now, by the way, not a Georgian anymore. He is a Ukrainian member of parliament, too. Fun fact, he gave up his citizen and joined Ukraine. But essentially, Saakashvili became president, and he said that he is in favor of expanding Georgia to EU membership, which is funny because Georgia is not in Europe. It is, you know, next to Azerbaijan and Armenia, which are nowhere in Europe, right? Mm-hmm. So he wanted Georgia to join EU and NATO. Now, this is obviously very, very scary for Russia because obviously former Soviet Union territory, obviously, and also borders Russia. Now, Georgia had these two breakaway regions, much like Ukraine has, right? It was South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And essentially, you know, right now we are seeing Putin being blamed for the war in Ukraine, but the same thing happened in Georgia. Putin was blamed for starting the war. But even BBC now later corrected that actually it was Mikhail Saakashvili of Georgia who started the war, when he started basically carpet bombing those breakaway republics in Georgia. And ultimately his troops ended up getting inside Russian territory. And this was not acceptable to Russia. So Russia essentially came in and liberated those two. Or if you are, you know, not if you are a pro-NATO listener, then basically broke away the republics from Georgia. So essentially, you basically have these two independent republics now, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, which are partially recognized. They're recognized by, you know, countries like Venezuela, Syria, and Russia, you know, all these countries. But that's what happened with Georgia. And Georgia thereafter, you know, basically America left it to rot. You know, it's not like America came to help. It's not like America, you know, the NATO or European Union came to help. It just, you know, left it be. And that's essentially the same story.
Sounds familiar.
Same story with Ukraine. You know, you give them the stick, so you give them the candies, like, oh, you know, you're a dog, I will give you a treat, come here. And when you come here, it's like, oops, sorry, no, I'm not giving it to you. And that's basically what's happened. And ultimately, you know, when it came to the Russian invasion of, liberation of of Ukraine, basically what happened is Georgia said they are not going to sanction Russia. Two, 3 days ago. Now, this is obviously, you know, interesting because now Georgia is saying, you know, we're not going to sanction Russia. And Russia has now become one of Georgia's top three trading partners. So it goes on to show that, you know, Russia will go to any and all lengths to defend its sphere of influence. So now, heading back to Ukraine, once you look at maps of Eastern Europe, you will see that after the Warsaw Pact was disbanded, Ukraine and Belarus were effectively the only buffer states that Russia had from Eastern Europe and from NATO. You know, especially after the Baltic states, you know, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia expanded in towards they're bordering Russia. That's sort of the only weak point they have left. But other than that, Belarus and Ukraine were the main ones, were buffer states. But the issue begins in 2014, slightly before that. And essentially what happens is that Yanukovych was given an option to join NATO join European Union first. And, you know, but essentially what happened is Putin was obviously not going to allow that to happen. So he suggested that the IMF, Russia, and European Union come together and give him an economic package that ensures the neutrality of Ukraine as a buffer state for Russia. But obviously the West did not pay attention to that demand. And what Putin was left with was the only option, which was he gave a $15 billion line of credit to Ukraine. And, you know, Ukraine at the time, being led by Yanukovych, obviously accepted the Russian proposal. And this angered basically the urban population, the educated population, the NGOs, obviously, and they started their protest. The Maidan Color Revolution started. And you saw all these people like John McCain and even Secretary of State. I think he was Secretary of State at that time, but I think it was Clinton. But John Kerry was also there in 2014 in Kyiv.
And basically, cookies and shit.
Exactly. So it was just like, you know, foreign policy blob of Washington, D.C. united, and basically people from both sides of the spectrum were there cheering on this color revolution that they were blatantly saying that it is a color revolution. You know, you listen to the, you know, recordings and documents released from former ambassador Victoria Nuland and, you know, Michael McFaul or whatever, and all these people are like pretty adamant saying that this was obviously, you know, we did color revolution or whatever. So it's pretty, you know, evident that this was what happened. And effectively, obviously, Yanukovych had to flee. And in place came the more Western-friendly government. And what this Western-friendly government began doing is, obviously, like I said that, you know, earlier in the episode, Ukraine is divided between sort of the Western-Northern regions are pro-Ukraine and the Southern-Eastern regions are Russian-speaking, Russian-ethnic regions. And essentially, they removed Russian as a secondary official language of Ukraine, and they started persecuting the Russian minorities. And this was sort of the reason that Putin was like, you know, this is not acceptable. You have a sizable Russian population. You know, it's like, imagine, okay, just imagine if your country was created, let's say United States was created with a 35 to 40% Hispanic population. And, you know, Spanish was like the second language of America. And suddenly, you know, the hashtag white people decide that, you know, we're not going to have Spanish as a language. So obviously it's going to create a lot of issues, right? So this is basically what happened. And the case obviously here was that Russia was the power who could take action against this. So obviously there were efforts to, you know, tell them to don't do this, don't do this. I'm telling you, don't do this. And then ultimately he was left with no choice but to take over Crimea. And essentially what began thereafter was a civil war in the, you know, Donbass and Lugansk, basically are breakaway republics in Ukraine, similar to what happened with Georgia. But these are obviously Russian-speaking areas. And, you know, they started, obviously Russia did not recognize them. No country recognized them. Russia only ended up recognizing them just before they launched their in attacks in Ukraine. But essentially, this is what the stalemate was. And obviously, then there was the Minsk agreements where, you know, it was Putin was trying to say that, you know, do not join NATO, ensure that you do not, you know, go inside the Donbass and Lugansk republics, do not attack these republics, and, you know, we'll be fine. We have to ensure neutrality. I do not want a war. And actually, it was Ukraine that's, you know, started not following the agreements, the Minsk agreements, because what happened is, obviously, they stopped the water supply to Crimea when Russia took it over. And essentially, if you look at maps of greenery and, you know, forestry and, you know, vegetation in Crimea, it's basically the entire northern to western part of the peninsula has basically dried up. So trees and, you know, vegetation only exists in the southeast of the peninsula. And it's basically sort of becoming a dire situation because Crimea's economy initially, when Russia took it over, began to rise because Russia made a huge bridge connecting Crimea to the Russian mainland. But ultimately, the lack of water supply meant that they had to, you know, the economy started to suffer. But, and, you know, that's what happened. And one of the escalation points, obviously, came into this conflict was Joe Biden himself, because Biden was the one during this Minsk agreements, during this entire time, who was supporting the color revolution when he was in vice president. And thereafter, obviously, the entire Hunter Biden scandal of Burisma, oil companies, and so on. And thereafter, even Russia began the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that basically gave them access to the German market, bypassing Ukraine. That's what troubled Ukraine a lot, because it meant that they would not be able to collect transit fees from gas and oil pipelines from Russia. And that formed a very big part of their economy. They would get like $3.5 to $4 billion every year from just gas transiting through their territory. And that Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which now doesn't exist, I mean, it's been suspended, that is basically eliminated $3 to $4 billion of their GDP, which is big for, you know, because Ukraine still to this day has not recovered from the economy it had in the Soviet Union. After the 91 crash, the economy slightly recovered, and then it just stayed, it has stayed stagnant almost for the last 15 years. And, you know, this just made everything even worse. And obviously the entire Hunter Biden Ukraine scandal, Russiagate, obviously has its own sort of idiocies that contributed to the scandal, because America was the one that was, you know, putting the matchstick and lighting the matchstick on fire from the West. And essentially what this meant was, you know, you will see basically Ukraine began the attacks in Donbass and Lugansk, which is precisely why you saw a massive wave of refugees coming in to Russia. And this brings me to a very important point, which I posted this a couple of days back, is you will see there's this video that has been going around a couple of days ago about how there's this father who is saying goodbye to his daughter boarding a bus because he had to stay and fight and so on. There was a very emotional video. Turns out that video is not of a Ukrainian father. That video is actually of a Donbass father who was sending his wife and kids away to Russia in a refugee camp, where they were giving like $100 a month or something. And basically he had to stay and fight because that's what the situation became. So this is one of the aspects I will come to later about misinformation in this entire crisis. But basically, it was this that prompted Putin to effectively recognize these republics of Donbass and Lugansk, because Ukraine stopped following the Minsk agreements and essentially started attacking Donbass and Lugansk. And it was creating a massive refugee crisis in Russia, which they felt that the only option they had left was that if, we're not going to get water supply, we're not going to get guarantee of, them not being able to join NATO and so on. The only option left was to ensure that, we send in our troops. And this is what Putin did. Is a very smart move. He first recognized the republics, Donbass and Lugansk, and then he made a sort of mutual defense treaty with them, where an attack on one is attack on all, NATO Article 5 kind of things. And effectively, he sent in quote-unquote Russian peacekeepers into Donbass and Lugansk. And now, obviously, because Ukraine was attacking these areas, they attacked the Russian troops. And ultimately, Putin says, we're going to invade. Now, personally, this is something I have said on my own Twitter account as well, is that I was thinking the invasion was not going to happen. And there were actually many people. It was, people like Sagar Injeti, it was Matt Taibbi, and, all these so-called contrarian journalists who are usually right on many things with regards to American foreign policy or American domestic policy and all. But everyone was sort of shell-shocked about, how this happened. Because, firstly, we were not expecting a Russian invasion because it was so very obvious that, it was just clearly bullshit, because they were trying to say, oh, they're going to do it now. They're going to do it in Olympics. They're going to do it now. And it was just perfectly, coinciding with how Lockheed Martin stock prices were rising while the S&P 500 was falling, It was just something that made sense then. But ultimately, Russia attacked after the Olympics. That was part one. And, so I'm friends with a couple of defense analysts in India as well. And one of them was telling me he has friends in the Kremlin who were actually surprised themselves that Putin launched the invasion. But obviously they were not, very high level officials, because high level officials knew the invasion was happening. But these were sort of like, mid-level people, like, for example, the assistant to the deputy foreign secretary or something like that, which, is a big post, but still they're not as high as the top brass, the Security Council of Russia, that, the top brass of the diplomatic corps in Russia.
But they kept it pretty close to the chest. It
was very close to the chest. Nobody knew what was happening, right? But that was the first part. The second part is the scale of the invasion, because normally if this invasion were to happen, I thought, he's probably only going to limit it to ensuring that he can use Donbass and Lugansk as the buffer states between Ukraine and himself, if he's going to do anything. But it looks like, he's going all in for this. He launched within the first 2-3 hours, the entire air defense system of Ukraine was almost completely crippled. And this included not just the eastern part, but all the way to Lviv, Lvov, or whatever you want to call that city. But basically in the western Ukraine as well, all basically air defense was crippled. And this led to their sort of very quick march into Ukrainian territory. And there are obviously, it's not like everything is going great for them. There's a lot and lot of issues that are happening with the Russian sort of approach of how they're doing with this, because one of the things is that they're not using, the best of the troops at the moment. They're sending in, there's only one sort of semi-elite brigade that is being used. But other than that, it's mostly, the low-level conscripts and all that stuff are being used for this invasion, because they feel that we want to ensure that these people can, set us as proper base before we don't want to waste lives of our elite soldiers in this conflict, right? So the elite soldiers will come in later. That's number one. Number two is the Russians are showing incredible restraint with regards to civilian infrastructure. Because, Putin in his speech before the attack on Ukraine said that Ukrainians are essentially Russians. They're one blood with the Russians. And Ukraine was basically a sort of, It's not a real thing. It's a social creation of the Russian Empire and Lenin, Soviet Union. And his basic claim was that, you know, one blood, one brother kind of stuff. So his entire aim is to ensure he does not harm civilian populations, to show that he's doing all good and stuff. But what we've been seeing, obviously, from videos that even I've been posting on my Twitter, is that the Ukrainians are taking advantage of this, and they are, you know, setting up positions inside kindergartens, near hospitals. Yeah. And even the most this disgusting case I saw was, it's not like, you know, they were using abandoned buildings. Like, they set themselves up in defensive positions in the city of Kharkov. This was in the apartment building with people inside the building. And, you know, there was this guy saying, you know, don't use us as human shields. That's basically what it was. And this guy just shoots his foot. Incredibly weird stuff. And there was another video, obviously.
Guerrilla tactics.
Insane. And there was other video of, you know, because Ukraine came up with two policies. Number one was they were going to release prisoners onto the street. Not like that's going to backfire in any way. But the other one was that females and children can leave, but every male between the age of 18 and 60 should fight. And there was another weird one where they said that if you are any age, we can give you guns as well. So they were, you know, tacitly approving child soldiers, which was, again, very weird, but child soldiers is another main thing. But basically, there was a video of a couple of people escaping, trying to escape a Ukrainian war zone. And the Azov battalion, which was quite literally a self-described neo-Nazi paramilitary. Like, I don't like to use the word Nazi because, you know, we all know how much of a psyop it is in America. You know, anyone I dislike is a Nazi, and, you know, even calling Vladimir Putin as Nazi. But no, these guys are like, we are Nazis. Look at us. We are literally Nazis, you know. So if you're calling yourself a Nazi, you know, I mean, I can't really do much but say, well, I guess you are a Nazi. But these Azov battalion Nazis effectively just shot up civilians who were trying to escape because they were male and they were not going to fight for Ukraine. And there's like videos of this, and it's actually pretty, like, you know, I posted this, but I had to delete it because I know people who posted it got suspended. So I wanted to keep my account safe through all of this. But essentially what we're seeing right now is, you know, Russia is not using its full force. It's definitely not targeting civilians the way America targeted civilians in the invasion of Iraq. You know, when people say, oh, you know, Russia is moving so slow, it's, you know, Putin is losing the war already. I mean, I'm sorry, it's just like day six of the attack, you know. And when Germany, Nazi Germany, invaded France in World War II, it took them 6 weeks. That is, you know, 6 weeks to take over Paris. And in Iraq as well, when America was launching the war with approximately the same number of troops, and they also had many other countries around the world joining them, using their own bases in Middle East, in Kuwait, which was bordering Iraq, you know, it took them more than a month, 1 week and 1 month and 1 week to take over Baghdad. And in the meanwhile, they had to drop depleted uranium on Fallujah, you know, which is a city of 200,000 and still suffering birth defects today. But Russia is not doing any of that. And I'm not saying this as some sort of a Putin supporter. I'm not, in fact, a Putin supporter at all. You know, my grandparents vote for the Communist Party of Russia. But so we don't vote for
Putin. Yeah, we're not supporters. We're just bots.
Yeah, exactly. No, but the thing is that, you know, this is like a sort of very nationalistic conflict. And even the Communist Party, although, you know, they've been very anti-Putin, are supportive of the Russian sort of military adventurism into Ukraine. In fact, they were the ones in parliament who submitted the resolution to recognize Donbass and Lugansk. So, you know, I'm not saying this as some sort of Putin supporter. I'm not. I am, you know, I'm pretty neutral in terms of Russian politics. I think it's mostly futile domestically. But regardless of that. And, you know, at the same time, back to Ukraine, the logistical networks of the Russian supply lines and all this stuff are so abysmal. It's hard to even believe that they're actually going ahead with this. Is they are openly marching trucks and, you know, heavy mechanized weaponry on highways in a straight line, which is like the dumbest thing you can do, because there's like America is giving aerial intelligence to Ukraine, and Ukrainian has all these Turkish drones. I mean, they haven't been used all that much, but you know, they have conducted some strikes. And if you're marching your mechanized columns so openly on a highway in such long, like, you know, 80 kilometer lengths of just straight up mechanized convoys, it's so stupid. Like, I have no idea what they exactly plan to do with that. Other than that, there have been issues with regards to communication networks as well, and, you know, how basically Ukrainians average Ukrainian citizens are basically tapping into Russian radio wave signals and stuff. But again, I'm not some sort of military specialist. I do not claim to be, but this is what I know so far. But
it's a trucker convoy. They're honking. That's
yeah, no, exactly.
Protect the vaccines.
Yeah, they're real working class. I support the working class for Russian troops. But, you know, just to sort of, I mean, the day today is March 1st, so I don't know when this will be released. But as of today, the situation is that the Russia-Ukraine held a first round of talks in Belarus. And they're going to be hosting the second round on March 2nd, which as of today is tomorrow. So I don't know what's going to happen there. But the first round did not yield any results. But basically the situation now is that, you know, from Donbass in east of Ukraine all the way from the south, the Russian troops have linked up with the Donbass and Lugansk troops, and they're going to be taking over the city of Mariupol. Mariupol is very important because this is the headquarters of the self-proclaimed neo-Nazi Azov battalion. And, you know, this was Putin's main sort of aim, is that he said that his operation is to denazify Ukraine.
Yeah, and, that's a nice touch.
Yeah, exactly. No, but finally enough, you know, when you look at the, there was a resolution submitted everywhere to condemn any and all forms of neo-Nazism in around the world, right, in the UNGA. And basically every country was in favor of it, except Germany, which abstains, surprisingly. And the only two countries which vote against this are the United States and Ukraine.
Of course.
So, I mean, I don't know what's up with America voting against it, maybe because of their entire free speech of, you know, everyone deserves, you know, free speech, which I can understand. It's, you know, the First Amendment and et cetera. But, you know, Ukraine is just too on the nose for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of weird. But other than that, Russian troops are in the outskirts of Kiev. They were pushed back a little yesterday because Russia slowed down some operations. But other than that, the Antonov Air Base, which is a very fierce battle, belongs to Russia so far. Kiev is being invaded, and you know, there was actually they wanted to strike the information tower of the Ukrainian version of the CIA, the SBU, and they basically gave a warning for civilians to evacuate before they could strike it. So, you know, Russia is still trying to ensure they do not get civilian casualties on this. And at the same time, Kharkov is under heavy shelling. That's one very, very key area to look out for, but mostly the south is you know, Mariupol and, you know, et cetera, is under control of Russians. They're trying to take Kherson. Odessa is, very little activity happening in Odessa, which is a very major city for Ukraine. But other than that, it's, I think the main aim is to take Kharkov and Mariupol and Kiev. I think those are the three main areas they want to take. And, you know, Odessa and Kherson are also the secondary targets. But that's basically the situation so far. And in terms of international support, essentially what you have is the UN Security Council had a resolution to condemn Russia for their invasion. And yeah, so basically every country voted for it, except Russia, obviously. But there were some countries that abstained. And obviously China abstained. And obviously India, which has very strong historical ties with Russia, also abstained. And
loyal friends right there.
Loyal friends right there, yes, yes. And one of the funniest ones was obviously the UAE, which obviously has American troops on its soil. And, you know, it's a very strong American partner in the region. The UAE abstained, and which was also very surprising to a lot of people. And then obviously a second resolution came and these countries again abstained. And I think the matter is being taken to the General Assembly right now. So that we'll see what happens over there. But other than that, that's basically, you know, what happens. And one of the major sort of things is that, because obviously, you know, I'm part Indian, so I have to talk about little, is so obviously India abstained on the resolution, and the Ukrainian ambassador told us, oh, you know, you have so many nationals in Ukraine. And more or less, he said, funny if something happens to them. And basically what happens, you see these videos of Indian students being, you know, harassed and tortured by Ukrainian forces trying to leave. And, you know, African students are also being stopped to leave. There's a lot of violence being committed against them, and it's pretty, you know, messed up. And you know, there was these reports being coming out, and basically, you know, everyone is, Indian Twitter is basically going on, you know, rampage against Ukrainians. But it's pretty mm-hmm. weird. But obviously not the lib Twitter, the sort of the sane people in India are going against rant. Libs will be libs everywhere, you know. But that's basically the sort of summary of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the historical reasons for it, how it links to Georgia, NATO expansion under Bill Clinton, and, you know, what the geopolitical situation is today in terms of military, and, you know, what the UN voting system is with regards to that. Yeah,
that was a great summary. I didn't know mm-hmm. I didn't know a good amount of that, but yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like a, yeah, I, like you said, I just remember Georgia being the last thing, and that was a while ago, and Crimea. I mean, you know, it's always a matter of perspective of like, oh, you know, who's the aggressor, right? Is like, yep. is Putin the aggressor, which is how they're framing him, at least in our media. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, is he, you know, the way I like to think of it, he's doing land back activism.
Yeah.
He's reclaiming land that was stolen from him.
Indigenous Russians.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you think about it in a broader context of like, you know, us sort of chipping away and surrounding them, you know, which is what we've done since World War II. Yeah, exactly.
Fucking NATO was created like as like right after the Truman Doctrine, and right after the Marshall Plan, essentially like as a way to combat Russia's sphere of influence. And you know, that was kind of meant to go up against the Warsaw Pact and such, which you talked about, Alexei. Mm-hmm. But the Warsaw Pact, it disbanded, you know, dissolved, and NATO still around, you know. Soviet Union dissolved, NATO still around, still being very aggressive, still, you know, encroaching on Eastern European countries, still trying to exert America's will and continue their kind of general theory of containment, except now it isn't really communism that they're trying to stop the spread of. It's just anything that goes against the multinational interests of the American elite.
Exactly. And funny thing as well is that actually Putin himself said that he applied to join NATO because, you know, he said that ultimately.
Really?
Yeah. No, there's literal documents of him saying that, you know, and there's actual documental proof of him applying to join NATO, applying Russia to join NATO because he felt that the Soviet Union is disbanded. So there's no point of, you know, sort of. And this was obviously in the case of American unipolarity. So obviously it was, you know, like, you know.
Can't beat them, join them. Yeah.
Exactly. And at the same time, it was just a test as well to see if they would take him in. And obviously they didn't take him in, and that was like, you know, yeah, they're still going to do some funny stuff, and it was proven that, you know, ultimately they are going to do it. And another thing I want to talk about with regards to this is that, you know, people think that this is some sort of Putin problem of, you know, if this was some other leader, they're not going to do it. They don't understand the fact that this is, you know, Russia already tried the liberal democracy. They already tried, you know, the sort of, it's okay, we are going to try to assimilate into the Western order. And they tried their very best under Yeltsin. And, you know, what happened was the biggest drop of life expectancy seen under Russia, the complete decimation of the Russian economy, privatization, like, you know, mass privatization of the Russian economy. And
sounds American to me.
Exactly. Yeah, no, like, imagine exactly. Like, it's like the depths of despair situation, but accelerated inside just, you know, 6-7 years. And at the same time, you know, Yeltsin was basically going to lose the election. He loses re-election to the communists because of how actually shit the situation got. But the Americans actually had to come in and rig the election. And there's like an entire Time magazine cover, Yankees to the Rescue. Look it up. And it's basically just
how they secured and fortified the Russian election.
Exactly. You know, they said that, you know, we're coming in, we're bringing mail-in voting to Russia. And this, you know, we're going to ensure the communists don't come up. And that's basically what it was. And, you know, they tried all that. But obviously, what did that lead to? It did not lead to anything because ultimately, you know, even Putin, when the 9/11 attack happened, there's a memorial in New York, the Teardrop Memorial. It's basically donated from Russia to US, right? I'm not sure if it's in New York or Washington, D.C., but it is like a memorial with a massive teardrop on it. And that's Russia's donation to America under that time. And, you know, it's pretty, you know, it's actually normal to see what Putin is doing because he has broad support on this from the public in terms of political parties as well. You know, you have people to the right of him. You have Vladimir Zhirinovsky. He's like basically, oh my God, I don't know how to say. It's like if Donald Trump was on cocaine and, That's basically Vladimir Zhirinovsky. And he's like this like ultra nationalist, like, you know, imagine if Trump had some sort of idea of what he was doing. So that's basically Zhirinovsky on the right supports him. The communists on the left support him. And even, you know, they were trying to do a color revolution with Alexei Navalny in Russia. Alexei Navalny supports this. He supports this invasion or war in Ukraine. So this entire thing is not an issue of, you know, if you remove Putin, we're going to get some other guy who is in power. No, Putin was, in fact, you know, when Yeltsin resigned before the 2000 New Year and Putin was supposed to take over, the communists were still very popular because nobody trusted Putin or what he was going to do. And, you know, he was Yeltsin's successor and Yeltsin was widely hated. And essentially, Putin was brought into power with support of people like George Bush and Tony Blair. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, as a bulwark against anti-communism and stuff and stuff like that. But, you know, and Putin now obviously is the sort of number one hated figure apart from Xi Jinping for the West. And it's essentially what I've been saying for a while is that every civilization has its own ethos, and that ethos can be disrupted temporarily, but it can never be disrupted permanently. And, you know, the imbalance of power, the sort of spheres of influence, those things are never going to go away. That entire liberal internationalist end of history utopia is never happening. Yes. It happened for a little while. It's gone now. It's more or less gone. China is going to try to get its own sphere of influence. Russia is doing that. And, you know, it's just not something that's just going to remain. And, you know, you remove Putin one day, you bring in Alexei Navalny. He's going to do what Putin is doing, but with even more racism, because the guy is like a white nationalist, quite literally. The guy has like videos of him on YouTube or like whatever, saying that how all sort of Central Asian migrants into Russia are cockroaches that have to be eliminated. So, I mean, it's this is the guy who's like, you know, the sort of poster child of liberal democratic color revolution. So it's, you know, no matter who you're going to get a Russia that's not going to back down on its right to have a sphere of influence. So that's what it is in terms of that. But yeah.
Man, it's funny how the liberal poster child for color revolutions is always like the most backward and reactionary person that exists in that country.
Exactly.
Like the Azov Battalion as well. Yeah. Like, you know, they have to go after and fund these types of groups in order to, A, if they don't bring them into prevalence right away, they have them on the back burner so they can just hold whoever is actually like in the puppet government's feet to the fire there. Yeah. Like, so like they can kind of talk up and fund Azatov, and then they can use the threat of, oh, we're going to use Azatov to kind of like force Azov, their hand. You know, force their hand and cause Zelensky to lose his power or his place. And so, you know, you can kind of play that 3D chess in the background while overall you're kind of just trying to use Ukraine as just an additional fuck you towards Russia and extending our interest and our influence and trying to decimate theirs, which has just been like the American project for fucking 60 to 80 years now. So, I mean, it's so deeply in the psyche of Americans with Cold War propaganda pumped through all of our school and everything that, you know, really was only phased out, I feel like, a couple decades ago. That kind of thing doesn't go away. And so seeing the way that Americans have so quickly jumped on vilifying Putin and just kind of immediately saying like, oh, it's these dirty Russians and like these people are evil and vile and they're going to do this shit, of course. And then like cheering on the fact that the ruble is worth like 1 cent now. And that's going to like crush the Russian economy and crush like working class Russians. You know, Americans are now just cheering that on because, oh, the bad guy who, you know, has been the bad guy in all of our Marvel movies in the back of our head for all of time. You know, now we're actually getting to see we have a reason to hate him. And so it's just kind of unearthing all that like latent shit that was already there in the background, just like decades of like ideology and programming.
Exactly. Like, you know, if you look at, for example, John Mearsheimer is a very prominent American sort of international relations scholar. And one of my favorite when I was studying politics in university along with economics is he has a very good talk on this in the University of Chicago. He gives. And you know, essentially he says that the entire fault of this entire conflict can be avoided if we have Ukraine as a sort of neutral buffer state, because what the West is doing with Ukraine is they're saying that, you know, we are leaving the option open for you to join NATO, but we're not committing if you will join NATO. So what this leaves is it leaves Ukraine hanging, and at the same time, it does not give the guarantee to Russia that NATO will take in Ukraine, because you're playing both sides of the conflict, and it's not a responsible thing to do at all, because you know you're enticing the Ukrainians with something that's not going to happen, but you're also, you know, not saying the Russians that, you know, we're going to leave Ukraine alone. You're saying, you know, we might take it, we might not, which is, again, it's a recipe for disaster in that sense. So, you know, even Mears Heimark says that, you know, it's pretty hilarious that, you know, people are going on about, you know, anti-Nazism and so on. At the same time, you quite literally are supporting self-described Nazis in Ukraine. And that's basically the entire situation of it. And, you know, the funny thing as well is obviously before this entire Ukraine situation popped up was the two color revolutions they did, in one in Belarus and the other in Kazakhstan, which again, you know, the Kazakhstan one happened so recently, it got memory hold completely, right? It's like, it's completely insane, because what happened there as well is, you know, pro-Russian government, you know, using NGOs, US aid, and, you know, the National Endowment for Democracy, which is just basically the dignified version of a CIA, is using the same thing in Kazakhstan, and then quite literally doing the same thing right now in Belarus as well. Like a couple of days ago, you know, that Lord Farquaad looking woman, what was her name? Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, basically declared herself the new, you know, Juan Guaido of Belarus, and, you know, said that, you know, Lukashenko is not a responsible leader. He's teaming up with Putin. I am the new leader, and, you know, nobody gives a shit anymore. So, and the funny thing is, and she did this because, you know, Belarus passed a constitutional amendment, you know, after defeating the color revolution, is saying that now they are going to host, they basically have the authority to allow Russian nuclear weapons in Belarusian territory, and Belarusian territory can host Russian troops indefinitely. So this basically just means that Belarus is Russia effectively at this point of time. You know, that's the thing, because Belarus is being used as a launch pad for attacking from the north for Ukraine, but Belarus is not sort of getting directly involved themselves, which is Lukashenko has said. But there were some reports coming in about how the Ukrainian military is considering a preemptive sort of strike against Belarus for allowing Russian troops. So that would be very interesting to see if Belarus gets involved in the conflict. But yeah, you know, Japan sanctioned Lukashenko as well, and, you know, there's been personal sanctions as well on Putin and Lavrov and all these people. So it's something that's not really precedented in, you know, I haven't really seen that against a major power sanctioning the leader personally, but it's quite hilarious. And you're going to see a lot of, you know, this entire stuff reflect in a lot of the economy as well. You know, I was posted a couple of hours back about how the wheat prices are skyrocketing.
Yeah.
Potash fertilizer prices are skyrocketing. Oil prices are skyrocketing, and you're going to have palladium prices, which are used very, very necessary to make cars. You're going to have skyrocketing car prices, and even the secondhand car market is absolutely disastrously overpriced right now in America and everywhere around the world, right? So it's basically a situation of, like, do we want to defend, you know, fake and gay liberal idea of freedom for doubling our cost to fill up our car, gas money or something? You know,
absolutely not.
Exactly. So, you know, we're going to have a lot of these issues pull up as well. And, you know, you're going to see a lot of instability in a lot of developing countries because they are so reliant on imports of wheat, imports of fertilizer, imports of oil, and all of these. It's just, you know, incredible, because you are going to see Arab Spring type revolts coming up in some countries within a year or two, because obviously it's a very lagging sort of thing. You know, food prices do not immediately impact situations, but they, you know, wait at least 6 months to 1 year and they will start to show impact. And that is, you know, going to lead to some sort of insanity in a lot of developing countries. But that is, you know, that is what's happening as well. And, you know, like I said, yeah, oil prices, metals, palladium, the most important, aluminium. And you have, obviously, like I said, wheat, fertilizers, and And seed oil. Ukraine is the largest producer of seed oil. So seed oil is
I'm even more
President Putin
now.
Please liberate
liberate these people. We need to put a stop to this.
I'm sold. it's very interesting things that are happening, especially in the financial world. You know, inflation is going to go even more insane now, because what this leads to now is, you know, obviously, there was this entire talk of, you know, American GDP is rising fast, and you raise the interest rates in, Powell can raise interest rates now because American economy is recovering. But this entire thing is not looking good for the entire markets. You know, the S&P 500 is creating, you know, Nasdaq created like a death cross today, which is the 50 moving average going below 200 moving average, which is not a good sign. In general, but obviously there's that, and, in general as well, this is going to be, Germany is already in recession. The Bundesbank said they're in recession, and energy prices in Europe are already reaching record highs, and German inflation, producer price index is reaching highs never seen since 1947. And it's Germany is going to be very, very affected hard by this crisis, but you're going to see a lot of sort of this trickle down as well into America. And that's going to be very interesting to see what the Federal Reserve does, because you're going to have slower GDP growth, and that kind of removes that entire impetus. So, at least the economy is growing, we can afford to raise the interest rates. But now the economy is not going to grow as strong, at least what the consequence of this is going to be. And you're still going to have even more inflation, and it's going to be like a period of stagflation. And will Powell basically make it worse by raising the interest rates 50 basis points, or is he going to destroy his own credibility by raising it by 25 basis points? So either way, it's a lose-lose situation for the Federal Reserve. And, apart from that as well, in terms of the economy, is, what has happened? There was a photo of how, citizens in Moscow Metro cannot use Google Pay and Apple Pay to enter the metro stations. Yeah. And this is just, they've been preparing for this for a very long time. They banned Trump on social media when he was president. Now even Russian media outlets are getting that notice that you have to be very careful when sharing their news. This is a Russian media outlet. Learn more how you can sort disinformation and stuff. And it's like a lot of, people are being branded Russian state media, and it's pretty insane the sort of propaganda narrative they're doing. Mm-hmm. And apart from this as well, they've completely destroyed their own credibility in terms of just, look what they've done with the financial systems in Russia. Look how they have basically banned average citizen from using Apple Pay, Google Pay. What makes you think they're not going to do this to, people at home in America? And you saw this example right now in Canada with the trucker protest and, bringing it back to that topic. But, people's bank accounts. Freezing bank accounts in Canada. And, doxing people, and you're having that situation now being used as an extension in international relations. And I think this was a very, point of no return step, because you cannot go back from this. You have basically showed to countries like China and India that you cannot rely on Western platforms of internet. You cannot rely on the Western cloud computing infrastructure. You cannot rely on Western payment gate infrastructure. And China realized this long ago with the Great Firewall. We mocked China for, they can't access the freedoms of Western internet. But in the long run, they're the ones who are actually much more secure. And India at the same time has noticed this as well, and they are creating an alternative to Visa. And this was a very big issue when Kamala came to India. She was trying to convince to not prioritize the Indian alternative to Visa and MasterCard. But I wonder why. But essentially, you're seeing the end of globalization in ending by America themselves, and you are seeing the emergence of regional spheres of influence in terms of military and regional alternatives to global existing status quo, made the payment structure infrastructure. You've got obviously cloud infrastructure, internet infrastructure, and even your banking infrastructure. Russia has its own version of SWIFT, which works internally. It's not the best, I will say, because they knew this was coming. They knew they were going to be removed from SWIFT, but they're trying their best to do that with Iran, because Iran is not part of SWIFT. And at the same time, the BRICS nation, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, tried as an alternative to SWIFT some years ago, but that did not materialize. But I think now when the next BRICS summit happens, you're going to see a lot of that under discussion, because it just goes on to show how, you know, almost anything can happen when the West controls the entire financial and, you know, narrative and internet sort of infrastructure. You know, you, like I said, you know, these wheat prices and these color revolutions that you're going to see in a couple of, you know, 1 or 2 years, you know, the new Arab Springs caused by insanely high food and, you know, commodity prices. Well, America controls basically the financial system and the internet, and the propaganda you're seeing with the Ukraine war, you know, the ghost of Kiev, the Snake Island, the people died as heroes, yeah. And, you know, all of this is fake.
Marvelification of war.
Exactly. Marvelification. Exactly. Thank you for that. And, you know, and the other thing as well, you know, Chechen commander Tushyev was killed and 56 Russian tanks were destroyed. Next day, he releases a Telegram video saying, I'm alive and here's my tanks. So yeah. It's pretty, pretty hilarious. So just how blatant the propaganda is. And when you try to correct it, you either get your account suspended or you basically get a tag saying you're Russian state-affiliated media and people cannot share your content. So it's pretty, pretty eye-opening in terms of people. You know, you're seeing all these conservatives in America who are saying, oh, you know, the liberal regime is our enemy. And now they're walking, you know, step by step with the same liberal regime to say Putin is a real enemy. It's just so hilarious. But, you know, the real rightoids, as I like to call them, are, you know, watching them. They realize just how insane this is going to be, because obviously they're taking it one step at a time, banning Trump and, you know, and then freezing bank accounts, and then, you know, delimiting Google Pay and Apple Pay in Russia now. And it's just one step at a time. And you can kind of see the development of a privatized social credit system in the cashless society that's going to come. And that is something that if you are not following your, as they say, not going to make it, NGMI. So it's going to be very interesting to follow. I think, you know, having discussed all of this, the things to look out for are going to be mass protests in response to food and commodity prices. You're going to see the development of regional spheres of influence, and you're going to see, you know, what do you call this? Alternatives to Western internet infrastructure, Western payment infrastructure, Western cloud computing infrastructure. And just basically, this is the end of globalization, the end of liberal internationalism, and the end of history. So the end of history.
And Lenin is coming back to strike from the dead with his theory of imperialism.
Yep.
Yeah, I think this actually hopefully would be, I mean, I don't want to speak too hopefully or anything, but I'm thinking it's possible this could be a decently good thing for the world with, you know, regional spheres of influence cropping up and alternatives to this globalized American multinational liberalism or neoliberalism, at least. I think that it's good because, like you're saying, it's showing these countries in like India or, you know, China, they already know with the Great Firewall and such. But they're kind of showing that you can't rely on these systems. And like you're saying, it's going to start, you know, causing people to try to develop their own and their own alternatives. And hopefully that kind of de-strengthens the corporations that are currently have a stranglehold on most of the Western world. And just the whole world in general. And then hopefully that kind of helps to fragment a little bit of that global order you're talking about. And I mean, shit, dude, regionalism, no matter how big of a scale it's at, I always prefer to, you know, this huge globo homo bullshit. So
that's up your alley. Yeah. Especially what you were talking about before of like, you know, what sort of, you know, other alternative channels do we have to communicate, you know, if they're freezing bank accounts and they're censoring everyone. Is relying on the internet at all just a trap in itself? And this, you know, this is still within the internet. It's kind of like what we were talking about before, but it's like if you have this decentralized sort of regional thing where there's alternatives, you know, maybe that's how you sort of get an alternative way out of communicating. You know, maybe we'll be hosting this podcast on some Chinese servers or Indian servers. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's what we'll have to do.
Dissident servers. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a good thing in general. Like, you know, am I very pro Russia? Am I very pro China? Do I want to live under those elites?
Of course not.
Probably not. But what I would say is like, you know, you know, seeing, you know, my main enemy, like Western neoliberal hegemony, getting, you know, fractured and getting checked in different directions is good, because they're the bigger enemy. They're my main enemy. And seeing them have to deal with these other enemies of mine is good, because then, you know, it's just fracturing their power. That's always good. You know, it's a win-win. If your two enemies are fighting, that's a win-win.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, the darker thing would just be like, you know, the West and just sort of dominating everything and there's no pushback. That would be even,
of course,
that would be a lot darker. But I guess, you know, the thing I'm wondering, you know, as we're talking about all this and you're talking about, Alexei's talking about, like, you know, the economic implications, and now they're saying, you know, we have a way to blame, you know, surging gas prices here. The administration here has a way of blaming it on Russia. Mm-hmm. And now we get, now, you know, it's kind of like how COVID just gave an excuse for everything in the economic downturn that was going on globally. Everybody now can just blame it on COVID. And now we can all just blame it on this. And, you know, to whatever extent that's true, or maybe, you know, they're just piggybacking on it or whatever, there's that extent. But to what extent, you know, you're talking about mass unrest and you're talking about, you know, all these negative externalities that are obviously going to come out of this, and that already came out of the downturn we've seen from the economy freezing globally because of COVID. What do you think of this whole, it's hyperbolic, obviously, but the notion of World War III, because that's like, I feel like every couple, you know, cycles that comes back, you know, there was the Trump North Korea thing, there was the Soleimani thing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if people, that it's kind of amazing how quickly they got memory hold. You were with us talking about it, I believe, like for a little bit, you know, when that happened at the beginning of 2020, like literally like the first month or so. Was it 2020? I forget when that happened. But it was very like quick. It just spiked up and then it was just like, oh, is this about to go down? Are we about to like get into a world war? And then it just went away. There was some retaliation and they said that there were some, you know, head injuries and that was it. Who knows, you know, the fog of war. And like, you know, I don't trust, kind of like what you were saying before, I really don't trust a lot of information coming from regarding like foreign affairs, because I just don't know. And I'm in America, I'm in PSYOP Central. Like I know everything I'm getting is like, you know,
it's like five layers of bullshit
propaganda. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So yeah. I'm skeptical of everything. And I'm like, you know, I don't want to have any. I'm wary of that handicap, at least. But to what degree do you think this might spiral out instead of just like a regional proxy thing to something more serious? Yeah, I don't think so either.
No, it's not going to happen. You know, the only sort of people begging for a nuclear war are just mentally ill journalists in, you know, United Kingdom or America. So, you know, you're not going to have a nuclear war. It is just something far too irrational. Because if you're going to have World War III, it's going to be nuclear. And it's just,
you think, generally... So?
Yeah, I mean, why do people have nuclear weapons, man? Like, if
one side, if you do the nuke, it's over, right? I mean, if you do a nuke, it's usually sure destruction.
Think of it this way: if you are, you know, someone who is losing the war really badly, what is the last ditch attempt you can say? Is like, if I'm going down, I'll bring you down with me. You know, it's just very logical. You know, nuclear weapons are going to get involved, which is why I am against nuclear weapons. Not because I'm some sort of, you know, world peace advocate. It is just that we can't have world conflict anymore between great powers. I want to see that conflict. You know, it's like we need to abolish nuclear weapons so I can see like the Russian sort of T-14 Armata tanks battling out with the M1 Abrams or something.
We need an even playing field of competition in war.
Yeah, exactly.
I have my miniature wars at home when I do the miniature battles, like, you know,
exactly,
it kills the fun if there's a nuke. Yeah,
exactly. You know, bring back Live Leak or something. But you know, exactly. So I don't think, you know, we're going to get nuclear war, and but there's not going to be World War III. This is just going to be regional conflicts. But there's something that is going to be more dangerous than this is going to be what's happening with China and Taiwan. That will be the one to look out for, you know, because this is exactly, if Russia can manage to hold the ground and get their objectives done in Ukraine, and obviously they honestly don't care about their economy anymore. It's not like, you know, obviously the Russian ruble has basically become worthless, but it's not like the Russian economy is, you know, completely different from what's happening all across Europe. Because if you look at the British economy ever since the 2008 crisis, it has been stagnant for the last 10 years. 12 years, it has been completely stagnant. You know, the GDP per capita, it's been completely stagnant. And you compare that to Russia, which is under sanctions, it is also more or less stagnant in the same way. So, you know, obviously I'm not saying that Russian economy is as resilient as the British economy, but they're like, you know, because British economy is obviously has access to much more markets and is not as sanctioned, but the Russian economy is far more autarkic now and realizes the necessity of using, not relying on Western supply chains as much, but ensuring the Westerners rely on their supply chains. And that's something that is going to be very interesting to watch, because Russian economy is not getting as impacted as you want. Obviously, like I said, the ruble is more or less gone. The Moscow Stock Exchange prices are plummeting, but you know, the rising gas prices, rising oil prices are just kind of dampening the effect. And, you know, Russia has vast currency reserves. They were very prepared for this war, because if you look at their currency reserves, they have increased significantly before this war started. And Russia obviously has a lot of precious commodity metals, heavy metals, and, you know, a lot of markets other than Western Europe to sell to. They're linking gas deals with, you know, China. India is buying oil from Russia, building of alternative SWIFT infrastructure. So I think Russia is going to take some time. It's going to be painful. But ultimately, they are going to come out of this situation wounded, but not, you know, hospitalized, so to speak.
Yeah, I'm hearing with China, they're sort of seeing this moment, and they're moving on Taiwan and making small steps, because they see an opening. And, you know, I mean, if you're either of them, obviously you just see America in decline.
Yeah.
And you think, you know, this is the moment to, you know, sort of.
It's now or never.
State claims. Yeah, exactly. Like, why, you know, why wait till if America recovers or whatever? This is the perfect time while your enemy is weak.
And Xi Jinping as well. Yeah, because his power structure is not very as secure as it's made out to be. There was a video posted, you know, in November or October last year, in 2021, of Xi Jinping basically having a sort of meeting. And when his name was called out, he stood up and everyone clapped. But when his premier, basically the prime minister of China, Li Keqiang, his name was called out, Xi Jinping did not clap. And this is sort of like the power-based dynamic between the two, because, you know, she is the princeling or whatever, and then there's, like, you know, different factions in the Communist Party. So he effectively has to sort of justify his turn away from Deng Xiaoping's ideology, Deng Xiaoping's globalization. And the only way he can justify that is by taking over Taiwan and saying that, you know, I took a nationalist turn for this reason. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's doing a lot of sort of popular policies, you know, video game restrictions, banning tuitions, encouraging families to have children. And, you know, he has quite a lot of support in the young generation, because the young generation is far more nationalistic because they're not as communist in general as the older generations. But ultimately, you know, it's going to be very tough tightrope on rope for Xi Jinping as well, because he has to justify his turn away from Deng Xiaoping's globalization theory, and has to justify that his nationalism is going to work out, and that the only way he can do that is through Taiwan. And, you know, if he screws that up, you're going to see some pretty big sort of, you know, war of succession type mandate of heaven bullshit happening in China. And
no way, really?
Yeah, no way. It'll never happen before. But, you know, that's the gist of it. Like, you know, obviously, you know, keep an eye on what's happening. And I think I've provided that summary of the conflict in Ukraine and Russia and Europe, but that's not where the real battle is. The real battle is in Asia. And the real battle is what is going to happen when China learns from this, because China always looks at Russia and learns. It learned to avoid glasnost when Gorbachev decided to have perestroika and glasnost. And they learned to avoid the democratization and to focus only on economic reforms. And, you know, that's the lesson they learned, that the power of the Communist Party must remain paramount, and only economic reforms must be done to ensure we strengthen our position on authority in China. And this is going to be also very important, because they will realize how Russia, you know, their attack was responded on by the West, and how they could face similar responses in if they do what they do to Taiwan. Because that's going to be, again, semiconductors and all this stuff to watch out for. So, yeah. So, you know, supply chain issues are not getting resolved, especially with this conflict. But it'd be very interesting to see what and when China does to Taiwan.
Yeah, this specific conflict itself here isn't going to spiral out into World War III. It'll be pretty regional, but it will have spiraling geopolitical implications that will be very, very instrumental in informing the way that the world shakes out going forward.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, I think it's interesting to hear about Xi and sort of the power dynamic going on there, because I feel like at least from here, we always make out the opposing forces more powerful than they are. China for sure. Russia, I mean, that's a lot of the Cold War was just making Russia to seem like this fucking, you know, gargantuan when it really wasn't, you know, just imagining that they had more arms than they did to justify our own bolstering of our own military. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like this downturn from COVID and everything in the last couple of years, I mean, it's affected every country. I don't think anybody was not affected by it. So, you know, everybody's sort of in a down period. I mean, I don't know if the wars, you know, helped them. I guess, yeah. I mean, it's really to help their standing among their own people, really. I mean, that's one of the main reasons. I don't know if it'll, yeah, I guess it could help their economy as well. I don't know how far we'll get involved. You know what I mean? I don't know if there's really an appetite for that, because, you know, like you said, like the rightoids don't really want that here. The left supposedly doesn't want that. It's really just a few people here, like neocons and neolibs, that want that.
And boomers, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but yeah. I've been seeing so many motherfuckers that are talking about standing with Ukraine and this, that, and the other, and talking about, yeah, Zelensky's the shit and all that. And like what that amounts to at the end of the day is like soft support for anything that we're going to do over there. I mean, while I don't think that most people want to get militarily involved, I don't think that that's a long, like, or like too much sharp of a turn from I stand with Ukraine and all this shit to like, oh, now we're gonna have to send 50,000 troops over there. You know, we gotta stand with them. You know, it's not, I don't think that people are like as repellent to the idea of war as they are like to the same level that they are indoctrinated into the ideology of the state. Like, I think that is gonna win out most of the time.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's just, it's funny too, just, they're making a lot of arguments, at least from the right, of like, Alex, you gotta go. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think we got a good hour, so we can definitely use all that. But yeah, appreciate you coming on, man. I know it's getting late over there. But that was a really good summary of
everything. Yeah, that was great.
Because we really don't know as much, so it's not our expertise for sure. So it's much appreciated, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure to, you know, come back and talk to you guys. It's really fun, and yeah.
Yeah, we got to get you back on another time for sure.
Hell yeah, hell yeah. Just wait for another conflict to happen and I'm here.
Yeah, I'm praying for Taiwan to pop up.
Recording a podcast in the middle of a nuclear holocaust. So.
Still wearing a mask and still social distancing.
Yeah, I'm wearing a gas mask in this case now. So.
All right, that was part one of our episode. If you'd like to listen to part two, you can find that at patreon.com/fedpost. Thanks for listening.